Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. And as the Tigers desperately try to persevere against the Boston Red Sox, in Boston no less, it's been hard enough in Detroit, but now we get to try to do it in Boston starting tomorrow night. Down 3-2, there's always Midnight Madness, I guess. Another MSU basketball season is getting closer, so have fun tonight if you're off to the Breslin Center. Coming up in our program today, Australian musician Harper, who is in East Lansing this weekend, and the Meridian Township musician Boogie Bob Baldori comes along in just a little bit. For now, Current State's Election 2013 coverage continues today with two of the candidates for at-large seats on the Lansing City Council. There are four candidates running for the two seats. We will talk with the other candidates, Kathy Dunbar and Ted O'Dell, next week. For now, Brian Jeffries was first elected to council in 2002 to fill an unfinished term. He won re-election in 2005 and 2009. He's an attorney who provides legal services for MSU students. Welcome back to Current State, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
And Judy Brown Clark is the diversity director for the National Science Foundation's Biocomputation Evolution in Action Consortium. Wow, that's a title. That's the Beacon Center at MSU, and Judy, of course, was a well-known athlete. She won the silver medal in the 400-meter hurdles at the 84 Olympics in Los Angeles, and she's married to District Court Judge Hugh Clark, and she's getting into the fray here for Lansing City Council. Welcome to Current State, Judy.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask both of you the question that we're asking all of our candidates for City Council. Brian Jeffries, if you're reelected, what single challenge facing the city of Lansing would you most like to help solve?
Well, I think the overarching issue that touches on everything that we do in the city is certainly our budget. We're coming off of 7 years of a deficit budget that, you know, we've really had to work with and struggle in terms of making, you know, identifying what our priorities are and making some very serious cuts in services. And when I look at that, I really try to focus on the neighborhoods and how that impacts the neighborhoods. I'm running because I want to continue to be the voice for the neighborhoods. And in addition to that, when we look at the revenue side of things, I think we have to consider what we're doing with our economic development efforts in terms of jobs and raising revenues in that regard. So I think all of those things kind of touch back on the budget and what we can do as a city.
Do you share the mayor's preoccupation with the longer term as well?
Absolutely. You know, we had a financial health team that came together last year and presented a report in March to the city that had both short-term and very long-term ideas and ways to address some of our issues. We've not really have gotten into that report, at least some of the long-term measures, and we had an update given to us at City Council a week ago, looking forward really to getting into that, looking at some of the long-term issues like our legacy costs in terms of our pension and what that means to the city in the long term, and really the opportunities that are presented through, you know, regionalizing and consolidating services with some of our surrounding partners. I think there's a real opportunity that has been presented because of the economy and which is outlined within that report.
Judy Brown Clark, what rises to the top for you? I mean, if you could pick a single challenge facing the city, what would you most like to help solve?
And not to sound like an echo, but I think the budget is really, if you think of a single point of entry that affects so many things that are occurring across the city, it would be the budget and fiscal responsibility and accountability and looking at what we have to do and funding those things and then looking at the things we'd like to do, and that becomes more of the contentious pieces to it. But I think we have opportunities to leverage with regional agreements as well as looking at ways to leverage maybe some untraditional dollars through grants and so on.
And that's how you see, I mean, assuming ongoing budget revenue shortages mm-hmm. and budget deficits, the first thing you mentioned was regionalism. That's what you would invest the most energy in?
I don't know if it would, well, I would definitely invest energy into it. I don't know necessarily how I would slice my pie, but I think that there's some opportunities and there's duplication with administrative pieces of you know, parallel efforts. And I just think that our services would go a lot further if we could take out some of the administrative pieces and just do the direct services, and we can do that with a regional model.
You're up against a Headley limit in Lansing, Brian Jeffries. There are not that many options in terms of new revenue. What kind of challenge does that create, and what do you feel the path ahead is?
Well, yeah, as I listen to Lansing residents and businesses, I think we're at a tipping point in the city in terms of taxes and assessments and fees that we charge. We just simply can't do that. We have to focus on the expenditure side of things and prioritize what those services are that provide a strong, safe city but are at the core of those services. And again, I want to go back to the regionalism. One of the ways that we can look at that is to look at partnering with some of our surrounding partners, such as Lansing Township with the fire services, East Lansing with our fire services. There is some duplication. We've had some success with the Potter Park Zoo issue, for example, and the 911 system. But there are other things that we can do as well. So. There's again, I think, a number of opportunities that are presenting themselves because of the situation.
Judy Brown Clark, besides getting elected yourself, are there at-large candidates you hope will lose? I mean, would you rather say Kathy Dunbar and you are elected as opposed to Brian Jeffries and Ted O'Dell?
Here's the beauty of being an athlete. I know how to stay in my lane. And what I've learned a long time ago is if you focus on your race and what you need to execute, then that's what you have control over.
But aren't there candidates you're more closely aligned with? I mean, the mayor's donated to your campaign.
Yes.
I'm fairly sure.
And you haven't yet, Mark. What is that about?
He hasn't donated to Brian's campaign, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. Does that suggest that you'd rather serve with Kathy Dunbar than with Brian Jeffries or Ted O'Dell?
What it suggests is that he thinks I'll do a good job. And I've been fortunate enough to have contributions from quite a few people across with UAWs, with the or endorsement by the UAW, by the Chamber of Commerce, Greater Lansing Chamber of Commerce, as well as the Labor Council and so on. So I have quite a few people that think that I'll do a good job, and I'm very honored to have their support. And
for better or for worse, the council is seen as having two camps, on either side of the mayor, Virge Bernero. Brian, you're often seen as opposing the mayor much of the time. Is that a fair assessment of your position? And what should the voters keep in mind with regard to this perceived split on the council? Yeah.
Well, I think perception is a good word. I think if you look at the body of work that we do as a council over any, say, 1 year period of time, what you would find is that we're probably voting somewhere 95% to 97% unanimously on all of the issues. I think you'll see where the major differences come in will usually be through the budget process in terms of, how we're putting the budget together and what our budget priorities may be. That tends to be where some of the argument comes up. But, the whole idea that there are factions out there, you do have some groups, I think, personally line up, together with each other. But as a vote, we're pretty much together on a lot of things. The mayor, when he comes out and other council members, really laud what we've accomplished in the city in terms of our economic development efforts, our reduced crime, increase in employment, et cetera. That would not happen if we did have this dysfunctional system that everybody talks about. For me, my position, I believe I'm a very independent person. When I go, my mode of operation is I listen to neighbors, I listen to neighborhoods, whatever the issue is, I study it very hard. And the decision I come to is one that I think is what is in the best interest of the city. And I will say to a T with all of my colleagues on council, I do believe they have in their heart what is in the best interest of the city. We may see it differently, we may come to it differently, but I think that's what we're all working toward.
Last May, I believe, Brian, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that you supported a cut to the economic development segment of the budget. Judy, do you favor cuts to economic development in Lansing?
I mean, I don't think you can make a general statement. I mean, you have to know, contextually what's in front of you, why you're making the cuts. So can I say, you know, emphatically that I would never make cuts? No, I can't. I can't make that statement. But I mean, at the point in time, I'll do my homework. I'll do my diligence. I'll look at the intended and unintended consequence and make the best decision.
And if I could clarify, that was not a cut that I was recommending. What we were talking about in the budget was that our TIFA district, for the first time in the history, has a budget deficit, and it's an amount of about $1.25 million. And the question is, how are we going to fund that? And the administration made the proposal to take the $1.25 million out of the general fund and pay off the debt service or fill that debt that was created by the TIFA. What I recommended was to have the TIFA enter into a loan agreement with the city where we would thereby loan them the money so that they could pay down their debt service and still remain afloat, yet at the same time, in some future time, they would repay the city that amount of money. We did that one other time. We found ourselves in that situation. It was in the boys training school development. We did that and actually had been repaid all those money. And so the bottom line was, I didn't think it should have been placed on the back of the taxpayer to pay for that debt service, that there should have been a loan and they should have repaid it over time.
But Judy Brown Clark, you were a candidate by May, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
You were. That was when the latest budget debate and the latest budget vote went down. Given how that unfolded, how did you feel about the budget at the time? Were you more a supporter of the mayor's budget or were you more a supporter of the council's budget?
Now, there are certain things that, I mean, the budget book that was put before the city council was not privy necessarily to the public, so I don't know all the issues. And I listened to some of the I listened to the Monday meetings, and I know that there were some things that didn't necessarily come in timely for decision making, and so it was hard even as a viewer to kind of follow how information was coming in. And so under that circumstance, I mean, what I can say or what I know as an outsider, because I was not internal to the process, is there are some things within the how would I have voted is what you're asking me.
Yes.
Knowing what I, as much as I know about it, not necessarily knowing all the details and having read the fiscal health team's recommendations when it finally went online, which was very close to the actual vote. If I were to vote, I guess at this point in time, there's so much more I know now than I knew at the time. So, I mean, it's a hard question to answer. I mean, I'm going to be very honest. I mean, I can say something that's very popular, but if I had to vote at that time knowing what I know or having not read the financial health team.
Well, given what you know now, how would you have voted?
I guess if I had to vote right now, or if I had to give a retro vote to it, I guess I probably would have. That's a tough question.
Okay, I mean the lines are clearly drawn, and I mean
no, because the lines are drawn right now as a faction, and I'm not trying to make a determination as a faction. And I think whatever direction I go right now, it gives a position that. Yeah. I know what your next question is. So anticipating your next question, I'm going to say, I'm not quite sure, Mark.
The mayor had his budget. The council had their budget. And
right.
When it came down to it, it was a one vote deal that gave the mayor his budget. I think given the fact that you're a newcomer, your vote in situations like that could obviously be very, very
important. And my
important.
Vote at that
could
point in
tip,
time,
tip would
have,
the scales.
I would have had the information that the council had at the time of making their decision. I was like everybody else looking at it from an outsider.
As at-large candidates, you would both represent the entire city.
That's
I'd like
correct.
To get your response to a comment by Catherine Mooney. This may be somebody you know. She serves as president of the Northtown Neighborhood Association. This involves city services.
We're pretty used to not having support in city services over there. So for us, these new fiscal concerns are just one more realization that neighbors have to come together to do what neighbors need to do for each other.
I detect kind of a go-it-alone kind of attitude there.
Well, the good news is with 1,500 homes, you don't feel very alone.
She sounds frustrated with the level of quality of the services that she's getting from City Hall. Brian Jeffries, are services inadequate right now, or is there a delivery problem getting services to Lansing residents?
Well, I think we're very limited based on the budget we have in terms of the services that we can provide. I think we try very, very hard, particularly when we go through the budget process, of reaching out to all of the neighborhoods to find out what those quality of life issues are that really make a difference for them. And when we look at parks and roads and sidewalks, I mean, that's where the focus has been. Public safety, top priority. But, you know, for the last 7 years, we've dealt with, you know, serious and significant deficit budgets that we've had to cut back on services. There's no doubt about it. Neighborhoods have pulled together. Some neighborhoods, for example, have taken over the maintenance of their parks in their areas so that they're able to continue to use those. And we've had to cut back on mowing services, for example, on those parks. We've had to cut back on certain maintenance items with our river trail at some points in time.
But when you encounter a really disgusted constituent, somebody who is really frustrated with the level of city services, mm-hmm. I mean, you basically come back with the budget situation, with the revenue situation, mm-hmm. and hope they'll understand?
Well, yes. I mean, they have to understand what the issue or what the problem is. Certainly, I don't want them to believe that this is an intentional issue on the part of the city to ignore one part of the city or one neighborhood or whatever the concern may be. I don't know specifically if there was a specific service that was being discussed up there. I mean, we, again, a number of reach out, go to the neighborhood meetings. That's where we hear a lot of these concerns. And if it's code compliance, then we call up code compliance. We tell them what we're hearing. We need you to get out there and take care of something. If it's a public safety issue that there's a rash of break-ins that are going on, we get with the police department and make sure they get out there to deal with those issues. So I think we're very responsive, but in the end, we're not where we were 7 years ago with the revenues that we had, the staffing levels that we had, and the attention that we could bring. But I will tell you, what is not going on is an issue where a call for service is being made, whether it's code or police or fire or whatever it is, that's not being responded to. You know, we just need to have that communication ongoing so we can make sure that those efforts are handled.
Can I piggyback on that? I think also there's a lot of things that are happening in Lansing that aren't happening in other places, like the recycling. If you look at East Lansing and Meridian Townships and so on, you've got, you know, repositories where you take your recycling. Lansing still has curbside pickup. I mean, so there are some advantages that Lansing has with services that some of our regional partners don't have. And I think what I'm hearing at the doors is people want to be heard. And I think when you take the time to explain, you know, there are some budgetary cuts, and so things that would have happened in the past aren't happening now. How do we partner together? And then, like with some of the partnerships with like green space, having business adopt green spaces as well as neighborhoods adopt some of the responsibility or shared responsibility, I think it addresses some of the feelings of not being heard.
Well, aside from the good things that are happening that may be overlooked, mm-hmm. On your website, Judy, you put improvement of city services at the top of your list of priorities as specifically as possible. What needs to change?
Well, we talked about regionalism. It's a way of stretching your dollars. If everybody blends their dollars together, it allows you to provide a service in a way in which no particular entity has to take full financial responsibility
for it. What's the lowest hanging fruit in terms of regionalism?
I mean, if you think about just like grass cutting, let's just start with that. I mean, if you think about partnering with the school districts, you know, to cut both, you know, some of the common green spaces with parks and cemeteries and even if you just looked at school districts that partner or border city property and just kind of put those dollars together for like this
shared administration.
Absolutely. Well, and actually it's shared services because administration can be centralized. So you're able to repurpose those administrative dollars towards getting people out on the, you know, out on the grass, cutting the grass. I mean, that's a real low hanging fruit right there.
We're talking with Brian Jeffries, incumbent Lansing City Council member at large and at large challenger Judy Brown Clark. Lansing voters go to the polls on November 5th to elect two of four candidates to at-large positions. Brian Jeffries, there's been talk of paying city council members on a per diem basis, the point of which appears to be to encourage attendance at council meetings and committee meetings. Do you support that approach?
Well, we've that was given as a question. What I talked in terms of thrown back as my response was kind of doing a blended approach where there would be a base pay. We as city council members just don't go to city council meetings or committee meetings. We're spending a lot of time out in the city attending various neighborhood meetings, just doing a lot of different things. So I'd prefer an approach where you'd have a base pay, and then on top of that, a per diem pay for council meetings and committee of the whole meetings. And it's very similar, I think, to what you would find if you went to Ingham County. I think they have a blended approach. And but the other thing is, if you look at the city charter, there is a provision in there that allows council to create rules that deal with attendance up to and including forfeiture of office for certain non-attendance. So that may be the other approach you might want to look at doing. But in any event, however the compensation is going to be taken care of, that would have to be done through our compensation committee that meets every 2 years and would have to be dealt with in that way. The whole attendance issue, I think, is one that the voters is going to have to decide. They have to figure out, are they getting the bang for their service in terms of their representation that they have from the individual council members?
There are half as many meetings to attend now as there used to be.
That's
correct.
I mean,
that presumably would improve the attendance records. So.
Right. I like to piggyback. I don't support that because I think it undervalues the scope of the responsibility. It's not just about the meetings. It's really about when you're making a decision, you're talking to all all the stakeholders, all the partners, you're going to neighborhood meetings. There's a lot of things that happen off camera, and I think it undervalues the scope of the responsibility of a council member. And I think, like Brian said, if you look at, the charter, there's mechanisms already in place to address someone that isn't fulfilling the expectations of the job.
Arguably, are there situations where in which attending a neighborhood meeting might actually be of greater importance than attending a council meeting? Brian, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have been very lucky to be able to work with the Lansing Neighborhood Council, which is kind of the umbrella group for all of our neighborhood associations throughout the city. And we have this kind of unspoken rule that they're not going to set up neighborhood association meetings during a council meeting. I think council meetings are very, very important. They're televised. That's where people see and hear and try to understand what's going on in the city. I would hate to have a conflict there, but I want to say that going to neighborhood meetings is incredibly important to understand what's going on in that neighborhood, how people are thinking. I mean, there's two ways we can come at government. We can come here and say, this is what you need and this is what you're going to pay for it, or we can take the time and listen to the people and understand what their needs are, try to fashion, some sort of, solution to that problem, but also understanding what they can afford to pay for. And so that's the approach that I think I would prefer to take. It's a lot more time-consuming and involving, but it's a much better result.
There are always three members of the Lansing City Council serving on the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. Brian Jeffries, you're wrapping up a one-year term as a voting member on the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. To what extent do you represent Lansing on the commission, and to what extent do you represent the region? I mean, are there occasions when you're conflicted over your allegiance?
Well, the commission, I think, does a fantastic job in representing a regional approach, whether it's economic development issues or land use issues or our roads and things of that sort. But I'm there representing what the interest that I bring to the table are the interests of the city of Lansing. We have very specific needs in terms of our roads. We have needs in terms of how we want the region to look, and I certainly bring those issues to the table. One of the big votes that we took this year was the Michigan Flyer and how that impacted the airport. I got behind the airport, and that's where my vote went. And that's in large part due to the fact that I believe that, that airport has a tremendous impact, not only on the city, but Ingham County as well. But I think, that's where my interests were.
We've got one more question here from a listener who wanted to pose a question to our city council candidates. Let's listen to that.
My name is Jean Brisbo, and I live in the Home Street School neighborhood area. And my question is, my husband and I are both senior citizens, and we've lived in this area all our life, raised our children in the city of Lansing. Our question is, we are looking to move out of our current neighborhood, wondering why, as senior citizens, we should remain in the city of Lansing instead of going outside of the city looking for new housing.
Judy Brown Clark, why should a newly retired couple stay in Lansing?
For the same reason that they were in Lansing up to this point. Lansing has a tremendous amount of very positives about it. I mean, it's a state capital. We're rebuilding, like, you know, all cities across the nation, and we've had impacts by economic challenges. But I think things are turning around.
Very challenged school district.
And that's an opportunity to partner because, you know, when you think about people coming into a district, you know, especially when you're looking at young professionals, you're looking at people coming in with families. And so what can we do to partner? I mean, we're colleagues to the school district. So how do we work collectively together with the district to, address some of or partner on some of the challenges? But for Jean's question, I think it's the same reason she's been in here. Basically, it sounds like her entire adult life is, we haven't changed. We're going through challenges. And I think that we have that we can create the same sense of community, maintaining our safety, maintaining, a sense of connectivity. And I think the city council next year will definitely show that we're the catalyst.
Brian Jeffries, why Lansing as opposed to Pensacola, Florida?
Well,
we
can't compete with the weather, okay? I think that I was, in terms of listening to her question, I wasn't sure if she was looking for new housing as well. I think the last part of her question dealt with housing.
I just got the impression they're footloose and fancy free. Yeah. They've spent all their lives in Lansing, Michigan, 48910. Sure. Why not Pensacola, you know?
Yeah, well, I think they have an investment here. And, you know, we have seen through the last 7 years, again, we've gone through some really tough financial changes, but we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, if you look at some of the employment numbers, our economy, at least within the city of Lansing, the unemployment rate is down. We're seeing numbers, I'm not quite there yet, where our crime rate is going down. We are starting to see some new revenues, additional revenues over and above what we have had in the past. In fact, we were told by the administration that this year may be the first year in over 7 years that we're going to have a budget that's not going to be a deficit budget when they present it next March. So there are some really positive things on the horizon that I think are going to be able to address, continue to address some of these quality of life issues, but then get back to where we were in terms of being able to really take care of our parks and improve some of the amenities that we have that really keep people here and enjoying Lansing.
Well, we want to thank Lansing City Council at-large candidates Judy Brown Clark, the challenger, incumbent Brian Jeffries. We explicitly want to commend both of you for your willingness to serve and to be involved. So best of luck to both of you. Current state has learned that in the event of a tie, the tiebreaker will be a 400 meters low hurdle event. So Brian, good luck with that.
Who came
and
up
briefs.
With that?
You have to wear briefs.
Kathy Dunbar and Ted O'Dell will be here next week to talk about their campaigns for at-large seats on the council election day in Lansing, Tuesday, November 5th. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A boisterous documentary about boogie-woogie music featuring Michigan musicians continues to pick up accolades. The film Boogie Stomp features Okemos pianist Bob Baldori and his partner Bob Seeley. It's picked up awards at preview screenings around the country, including in New York City. And the movie's helping to fuel a busy touring schedule. Appearances by Bob Baldori and another collaborator, Arthur Migliaza, were recently announced that will take them to Russia for a string of performances. Here to update the response to the film and upcoming performances, Boogie Stomp's executive producer and star and hairstylist and muse and key grip. He does it, marketing executive, he does it all. Boogie Bob Baldori, welcome back.
Hi, yeah, I'm the janitor on that project, too.
It is, guy, you wear a lot of hats in a project like right. this, needless to say. Briefly remind our listeners who are not aware of Boogie Stomp what it's all about, the movie.
It's a documentary on the history of American music, really, starting at the end of the Civil War, and it sort of documents how the need for music to socialize, party, and dance to was the motivator for the roots of blues, jazz, everything all the way through to American pop music and modern jazz.
Well, let's explore for just a second the sound of the music, what Boogie Woogie is in its DNA. We've got your opening number in the movie queued up here. So what distinguishes Boogie Woogie exactly? What's at the heart of it?
It's rhythm and improvisation over a blues form, and it's happy music. It's music to dance to. And those basic elements, we get into the origins of them in the music, and we sort of tell the story as a somewhat of a buddy movie with me and Bob Seeley, who's recognized as the world's greatest living player of strident boogie-woogie piano.
And you guys, you hit the road in the movie. There's a lot of concert footage.
Right. We start in Okemos. We end up, and we go to Toronto. We do Birdland in New York City, and we end up playing the U.S. Embassy in Moscow on the 4th of July.
That was just last summer, right?
Well, no.
I've been there before?
Yeah, and I've been there three times, actually, in the last 3 years. And I just closed a deal. We're playing Tchaikovsky Hall in Moscow on December 6th. So, yeah, it's a world travelogue.
You are in Europe periodically. You're outside the country performing a lot of boogie-woogie. What accounts? Could you argue it's more popular outside the country than it is in the United States?
It has a real following. We played Rock in Rio last year, 100,000 people a night, and it was amazing. The people that came to see us knew as much about what we were doing as American audiences. They get on the internet, they track everything down, and they go crazy over the music.
Is the Russian tour your most distant tour yet, with Arthur coming up next year?
Yeah, it'll end up being the most distance because we start in Moscow and we play five cities and we get all the way to Vladivostok, which is like right above Japan.
Yeah. How did that unfold? How did this tour of Russia unfold?
Well, that's in the movie, too. I got a call one day, I think it was 3 years ago, roughly three, 4 years ago, out of the blue It's a voice saying, "Hi, my name is Vladimir. I'm about to take you to Russia." You know, and who knows? You know, I'm going, "Sure, Vladimir." And I operate on the Chuck Berry rule, as you know, first you send the money, then we book.
You learned that from Chuck Berry, okay?
And it was unbelievable, you know. But he had found us on YouTube, which a lot of people do, and he's a Russian producer. And this music has credibility all over the world, and he was serious about it. So eventually we worked it out.
Are there particular countries, though, where it's just really taken hold?
Oh, yeah, France, Germany. We played in Amsterdam, England. And there are players in these countries, and some of them are in the movie, that are breathtaking. I mean, they're just amazing what they, and they know more about, like Martin Schmidt, a German who is actually going to go to Russia with me this time, knows more about James Booker and Fats Waller and Ammons and Johnson than most American piano players.
In the movie, there are, speaking of extraordinary, there are also segments featuring some really unbelievable young dancers. Who are these dancers, and how did they come to be a part of the movie?
Well, they're William and Mava, and these two French teenagers who are living in Montpellier, France, are actually the top dancers, swing and Lindy Hop dancers in the world, and they had a viral hit with a YouTube video that they was recorded in Switzerland with a piano player who's a friend of ours, Sylvan Zing. And I was getting emails constantly peppered with friends saying, oh, you should see this video. And this had over 5 million hits. And it was terrific. I eventually looked at it. And I was looking for somebody to provide the dance element in the movie because it's so important. Couldn't find anyone locally. So eventually I tracked them down, sent them an email. And it turned out that they knew all about me and Seeley. They were huge fans. They were excited that I'd contacted them. They said, just send us a ticket, and we'll do whatever you want. So I flew them over to Okemos, and we put on a show at Okemos High School, and I filmed them, you know, with me and Seeley. And that's all part of the movie now.
And this is just exactly what kind of role do they play, though?
Well, they throughout the movie, we use them to demonstrate how the rhythmic and swing elements came, you know, into being, why these piano players developed all these different techniques, because they were doing it for dancers. Mm-hmm. And we weave them in and out of the story.
I would recommend, if you have enthusiasm for watching really talented people dance, it's really another reason to see the movie, regardless of how you happen to feel about Boogie Woogie music.
Right.
These are two young people who can really, really move.
Yeah,
so
they're amazing.
And you're going back to New York City to perform next year off Broadway. What's that about?
I just actually closed the deal last night. There's a theater there. It's an off Broadway theater, a very credible organization, and the producers and owners of the theater sort of fell in love with the movie and made us an offer to do the live show, which I've done in several theaters. I actually did it at the Stormfield, and I did it at the Boar's Head, and I did it at the Williamston Theater. It's sort of a live version of the movie, featuring the music more than the story, but the story's part of it. And I actually did it at the Glenn Gould Theater in Toronto and at the Gem Theater in Detroit, and they looked over the history of it, and they made us an offer to do a 3-week run off Broadway in New York. So I'm super excited about that.
How do you juggle all of this with the legal career?
I need help.
It's not pretty to watch.
I need help.
Much closer to home, you've got showings of Boogie Stomp set for this weekend locally. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Loc Cinema, Celebration Cinema people have agreed to do. They've been super supportive. They're a terrific organization, and they're screening, doing a preview screening for us tonight, actually, at Celebration Cinema, and then tomorrow and Sunday, both at Celebration and at Studio C, which is their wonderful new theater in the Meridian Mall. It's a terrific place to see a movie. And they're also screening it in Grand Rapids.
BoogieStomp.com is the website to learn more about this extraordinary movie featuring Meridian Township's Boogie Bob Baldori and partners Bob Seeley and Arthur Migliazza. And again, remember the performances here this weekend. Bob Baldori, many thanks. Continued success.
Thank you so much.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The musician Harper's music is often described as world blues. Harper's mix of roots music, soul, harp, and didgeridoo are all part of his unique sound. He will be bringing his distinct brand of blues to East Lansing this Sunday as part of the Pump House concert series. Harper spent the last decade touring around the United States, but as he told Current State's Emmanuel Berry, it was his upbringing in isolated Perth, Australia that influenced his sound.
There's not much there. I mean, like, there's only a million in the whole state, which is nearly half of Australia. When we first went, because I left from England, and we were living near London, and that was condensed living. So we went from that to living in open spaces almost, because it was very deserty and hot. But I didn't like it at first, but after a while I fell in love with it because I got into surfing, and it was a real beachy sort of lifestyle. And it was a nice way to grow up. It's very safe. Community to live in. It was just a lot of English people went there when they left Australia, and I think that's why they have such a big blues following in that part of the world, because they all came over and brought that love of blues. Mm. You know, the bands like Cream and all the English bands that decided to do blues music as their style. So that was a big part of my life. So there was always a healthy blues style there.
One of your last albums, it was a live CD titled Live at the Blues Museum.
Yeah.
What's it like recording an album live?
Well, that was easy, that one, because I had such a wonderful band to work with, so, and we'd been fully rehearsed. And I think it's easier because it's done. Once you've played it, it's finished. Whereas in a studio, you can be real picky about it. So, you know, it was easy in a way, because the guy that did it, Johnny V, who recently passed away in Canada, he was easy to work with, and it was just nothing. It was just like a normal gig, and thankfully it sounded good. We didn't make any mistakes.
Yeah, I feel like I would be so nervous the entire time that, oh my gosh, this is permanently recorded
on
the album. But if you're perfect, you're perfect. So would you play something live for us now?
Sure. I've got this song called Well I Know. It's just harmonica and vocals. So we'll give that a shot. 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I find it really hard not to fall in love with you. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know, but it really isn't gonna make a difference anyway. So people say love is all you need. I really don't ever wanna feel the way. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know, but it really isn't gonna make a difference anyway. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know, but it really isn't gonna make a difference anyway. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know what you say. Well, I know, but it really isn't gonna make a difference.
That was Harper playing Well I Know. I think two of the most distinctive things in listening to your music is your harp playing and your use of didgeridoo. Give me a little bit of the background history on this instrument.
It's actually one of the oldest instruments known to man. It's over 2,000 years ago, they picked up a tree and started doing the circular breathing through it. It's actually made by nature. Man has not much to do with it. It's a eucalyptus tree, and when they die, the white ants will eat out the center, so it's completely hollowed out. They can't eat the outside because it's too hard, so they leave them there. So some bright spark over 2,000 years ago decided to clean one up, take the bark off it, and then put some beeswax on the top and did this circular breathing. It took a while to get that. So basically all it is you're blowing a raspberry into it, but you've got to learn this circular breathing where you pump up your cheeks and then you breathe through your nose and pump the air out through. It's like bagpipes when they do it with the arm, squeeze it and it comes out. So that was a bit of work to do, but the Aboriginal people taught me how to do that. So, you know, it was a 6 month, 8 hours a day trying to get that thing going. And then the very first time I ever played with it, I designed a stand for it to put it. I only had one at the time. And it had some foam on it, on this stand. It was a small microphone stand, and I thought, oh, that's a good idea. So I put that on. So this is my first gig. So I picked the didgeridoo up to play it, and nothing's coming out. It's because the foam's stuck in the end. So can't that was my first live gig with it, no sound at all. It was a risky thing to do. And then eventually some Aboriginal dancers came along to a show, and I thought, I actually said to them, are you sure you're okay with me doing this? Because it's your instrument, it's very sacred to them. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we love your music, because I did write a lot of songs about their plight, pretty similar to Native Americans, how their land was taken off them, and mm-hmm. they just put them anywhere. No one really knew much about their history.
I read somewhere in your bio that you were saved by Aboriginals as a kid. Tell me about that.
Well, my father and I, my father was a truck driver back in the day, and in Western Australia, once you got past Carnarvon, which is a little north of Perth, say 100 miles north, after that it's all dirt roads, and he used to deliver stuff to the northwest right up in the desert areas there, and there was this one area, and we were green, we didn't know much about this, but there's this place called the Fitzroy Crossing, and when the wet weather comes, it goes from nothing to running water, fast running water, and there's two parts to it. It's like a fork that comes out between the two, and we crossed one, and then this water just came out of nowhere. So we were stuck between these two rivers, torrential rivers, and we couldn't do anything. We had enough food for probably a day or two. We were stuck there for 2 weeks, but after day two, there were some nomadic Aboriginal people coming along, walking along the desert as they do. They just wander anywhere. And we couldn't speak their language, they couldn't speak ours, but they knew we needed food and water, so they fed us, and we ate witchetty grubs, which are like giant maggots that live in trees. They're very sweet and yummy. Oh, they're yummy.
Okay.
But you eat them while they're still alive. And they have their own form of jerky. It's dried up lizard, and we ate that. And it was interesting, but if they hadn't been there, we would not be alive. We couldn't have made it through 2 weeks with no water and no food. So I always remember that, and I think it's strange that now I'm playing the didgeridoo, you know.
Do you feel like you're honoring that memory or honoring Aboriginals in
that way? Of course. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my songs actually talk about their plight, you know, and how they've been mistreated and how they actually have a deep – and we all have this soul that's deeper than the rubbish we deal with. I think a lot of us lose it after a while when we get into this – modern world we live in, a lot of that stuff's gone. Survival, you know, we forget how to do all those things. Generosity, giving, love, all those things, we tend to just keep it into ourselves. And they taught me to change that by even later in life when I was learning the didgeridoo. They came and helped me choose the proper didgeridoos. There's so many out there. You can buy one made in Taiwan now, or, you know, the wrong ones. So they helped me in that way. So, yeah, a lot of my songs are about them.
Would you play a little didgeridoo for us?
Sure. And I'll use my harmonica to hit it as well, so you get that sound. Mm-hmm.
That was Harper playing the didgeridoo. We have the musician here in studio talking about his music. His latest project is with Motor City Josh. It's called Bare Bones. Tell us a little bit about that CD.
Well, we were in Flint doing a benefit, and the people running it wanted both of us to go, and we couldn't put our bands together for that. So I'd known Motor City Josh for a few years. He's a great blues guy, excellent player. And we decided to get up unrehearsed and do some songs together, like old blues songs. And we really dug it, and we enjoyed each other's company. So after a while, we said, you know, we should just do this, you know, like put something together and just do a short tour of, I think in December and January, we're going to be touring around the country. And it's purely, the reason I called it Bare Bones was it's just acoustic harmonica and acoustic guitar. And we wrote all these different songs, but we used the styles of old blues, and it's something that we both grew up with. Of course, Motor City Josh is always playing great blues. He's a great guitarist. So it was an honor for me to work with him and go back to my old days and do something different than what I'm doing now.
Gonna hit that fence. Well, now come home. Stop staring at your phone. Just let it go. Stop staring at your phone. Yeah.
That track is titled Why Can't We All Just Get Along off of Harper and Motor City Josh's album Bare Bones. Harper will perform in East Lansing as part of East Lansing's Pump House Concert Series this Sunday. That's at 368 Orchard Street in East Lansing. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll continue our local, or a Monday on Current State, our local election coverage with Kathy Dunbar and Ted O'Dell, two more at-large candidates. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR. Oh,